This stole was made for me by a medicine grandmother of mine in the Sweetgrass Cree. And because of the nature of my conversation with you today, I thought I'd bring the memory of her spirit here, Flora Cardinal from Satellite. I'll talk into that mic, eh? thank you, Ed, for this invitation and for the trust to be alongside you. And thank you for your warm reception of me here. May the meditations of my heart and the words of my lips be on the side of the great breath of all our breathing. An astute social analyst by the name of Daniel Bornstein posited the observation that we once formed community around the shared experiences of our nationalities, our religions, and shared social purposes. But once we moved from a consumerist into a consumeristic culture, it put us in a collective mind space where we gather not for what we are for, but what we are in competition for. We have become a species of grievance-based gathering and entitlement-based gathering. What I fear you have and I don't have, and this creates very, very unhappy people. At the extreme, this mind space of grievance and entitlement-motivated gathering produces white supremacists, involuntary celibates, and all of the human discontent and flavors in its most pernicious presentations. The essential feeling contagion is one of self-justifying discontent, which is perpetually replenished by an absence of truth-telling where it counts, when it counts. Journalists who do ask the right questions and press for the right points have become an endangered species within our species, and the major media outlets are owned by special interests wealthy of our kind. I long for the days of Terry Molesky's probing inquiries, and Joe Schlesinger's stories into the story within the story within the story, or Barbara Frum's penetrating questions, or Mike Wallace and Morley Safer of 60 Minutes. They are gone, are they not? Our hearts are becoming increasingly desensitized. The old expression for this is called the hardened human heart, and our consciences are calloused. We erroneously associate velocity with efficiency. And so in the rapid laser lane speed of all the worlds that we are relating to and from, we do not get time to deliberate in gathering ways that are purposeful to the advancement of other interests beyond our grievances and our entitlements. In a bewitchment such as this, that promotes narcissism as a legitimate character condition, should we really wonder why there's such little holding interest in the phenomena that affects the good and the health of the whole? Where are the twins these days? Those two operations of the soul that have historically moved human beings to rise to the occasion of their higher angels, as Lincoln referred to them, freedom and responsibility. I'm with Daniel Bornstein when he maintains that to be born in North America is to be given a PhD in entitlement. At their worst, the implications of this are we do not know how to discern well between the paltry taking of offense and actual death-dealing, soul-degenerating evil, such as the kind that allows for the creation to be plundered and trashed upon by the interests of the big corporate oligarchs who murder its integrity and grandeur all the day long, with sustained mind-bending, breathtaking recklessness. The twins, the soulful operations of freedom and the responsibility, become partially awake and then lapse back into unconsciousness in an era such as ours. We are so easily distracted, and it's set up for us to be distracted. For my part, I am fully persuaded that to awaken is both a spiritual and a political path of inquiry that will inevitably also involve the path of descent into the realization that we are suffering far more than we are consciously knowing at the levels of our innermost psyches and souls. We are, in reality, in a massive collective crisis of conscience, which is perpetuated by a replenishing sense of despair and impotence to be of any kind of meaningful influence. This is our predicament. This kind of mind space is, of course, a delusion in part. That really grabbed my attention when I could see us in this delusion in part. Its implications of misery making are no delusion, but the mind space itself certainly is, and the heart-hardening, conscience-callousing powers at work in our collective unconscious lives, as well as those that ravenously gorge themselves on the economic aspects of the traffic of human interest, are counting on the twins to remain asleep in the deep recesses of our souls' lives. The twins are sleeping, and they almost awake, and then they lapse back into a snooze of unconsciousness. If we allow ourselves to adopt the twins that have been orphaned by our unintentional neglect of them, something really can happen. Our biological brain benefits just as much as our biological hearts by the production of dopamine. And dopamine is also encouraged by what the soul wants, dispositions such as kindness and the desire to learn and wonder. When the brain is obliged with kindness, which is a soul operation, the biological effects are wonderful. Human beings actually produce dopamine when they are kind, when they wonder, when they are curious, when they want to learn. We know that this brain loves it, and we are kind, and imagine, we have science on all this stuff, because we do. So when we use our energies to betray our deepest values by enduring situations and relationships that ought not to be tolerated, we fail to have the strength to make needed change. We abide stuff we should not abide. As I was thinking about that statement and writing it, I was taken back in time to my age of 28, and I was sitting with Fred Horse, who was my medicine grandfather from the Sweetgrass Cree. We were sitting on a precipice, a beautiful precipice that overlooked a sage field. And there before me, he sat, and I sat before him. And in his hand, he was holding a sacred pipe. It was a very old pipe, and it was very important to him. And he sat and examined me without saying a word for 5 hours. He didn't say a word. He just simply read my spirit. And he watched me, and he examined me for 5 hours. And then he said, "I am ending and you are beginning. Do you know what I am trusting you with this day?" Fred Horse had been taught the sacred pipe by a man named Wapshtigans, who was a medicine person of the Sweetgrass Cree, who had kept all of the ceremonies that were against the law and to be practiced by the Canadian government. Wapshtigans would hide in thickets and smoke the pipe low to the ground when the RCMP would be looking around, trying to find Indians doing Indian doings. He kept the sun dance, he kept the sweat lodges, he kept the ways of the sacred pipe, and he taught Fred Horse, who is now sitting across from me. And he said to me, "Our Creator loves both tenderly and severely. Note the tenderness and the severity of our Creator's love. I'm going to tell you why it has been hard for us. It has been hard for us because there was a time when we had agreements with the spirits of this land. The Great Spirit had given us a family relationship with everything that is in this country, in this land. We were friends with the beaver. We were friends with the mink. We were friends with the otter. We were friends with the bear. We were friends with the spider. We were friends with the coyote. We were friends with the wolf. We were friends with the storms. And we broke our friendship with them when we got greedy. Because when the newcomers came to our country, we left our friendships. The injuring of a spirit is a very serious thing. When you walk the way you walk in this life with what I give you this day, remember, when you injure a spirit, it's a serious thing. We injured spirits when we went to our lower selves and followed the ways of take and take and take. And we grieved our spirit friends, our spirit family, in all manner of ways. And that's why it's been hard for us in our own country. At that moment, I realized how tremendously courageous that was for him to say to me. For him as a Cree, whose ancestors had been alongside Big Bear and Poundmaker, and how they had showed restraint against killing people in their resistance against Sir John A. Macdonald's national nightmare as far as the Cree were concerned. It wasn't a national dream for the Cree, it was a national nightmare. And he was teaching me that freedom and responsibility are the only way to live. Without them, we cannot live. We have freedom to choose. We have freedom to self-express in this country, still. And we have a responsibility to self-express. We have a responsibility to resist evil. And evil is anything that deals in lies, and lies deal death. So as I think about that, and then I thought about when I left that occasion, I went to Marathon. And I went to Marathon at a time in which the local mayor had been pedophiling kids for 27 years. As a school teacher, a renowned business person, minor hockey coach, chair of the Chamber of Commerce, and that there were priests moving up and down the highway by a bishop who knew were pedophiles. This was in the 1980s. When I arrived in Marathon, some police officers that were in my congregation approached me and said, "Welcome to Marathon." I said, "How do you find it here?" He says, "The place is great, except their mayor screws kids. But other than that, it's an okay place." And they were understandably cynical, because every time they would try to investigate the violation of children, somebody in the adult world would always be running interference. Power takes care of its own. And history on the side of those who have lost is a very different history than those on the side who are winning. The side of losing is always the most credible side to believe. I've come to learn that. So in the course of my becoming a chaplain to these seven constables of the Marathon Police Force, oh my. So through the influence of dreams, because certain Cree spirits were showing up to me in dreams and guiding me in a process to speak in metaphors about how power was being misused in Marathon. So I was writing in the Marathon Mercury with regularity. And so one day, against what the Reeve was doing, but I was using metaphors to describe it. One day, two of his former victims had been walking down the street, and Dick Tennant was a police officer coming out of the police building, and he happened to come across them, and they're reading an article I'd just written in the Marathon Mercury, and it was on Halloween, the day before All Saints Day. I'd done that on purpose. And so Dick asked the kids, they were now 18, 19, he asked them, "So what are you reading? They said, well, we're reading something that the Reverend wrote. And Dick said, well, what did he write? So they read it. And Dick said, and then the kids said, yeah, but, you know, the Reverend's got it right, but he doesn't know the half of it. So Dick said, why don't you tell me the other half of it? So they came into the office, and they relayed what Bill Springer had done to them. By the time that conversation ended, there was 54 counts of buggery and indecent assault on male children. When the chief came, and Dick presented the evidence to the chief said, you got nothing here, this stuff's going south. So he's about to throw it into the waste paper basket, and Dick says, I can't wait to hear the thud of that paper on the bottom of that basket, because when it does, I'm going to arrest the chief for obstruction of justice. The chief says, all right, but you bastards aren't going to get credit for this. This is going OPP. So across the street, the evidence went, and the OPP said, what do you mean there's nothing here? And on December 15th, in accordance to the owl spirit that had come into my dream and told me, Bill Springer was arrested for 54 counts. Now the chief, because he had obstructed justice, really, for years, became somebody who I just knew I had a responsibility to keep pressing for, because he was also abusing his officers in ways that were threats and all kinds of things. So we had a public inquiry eventually, and in that public inquiry is where I lost my innocence in right honorable titles in our country, because the lawyer that had come from the Solicitor General's office from Toronto said to me in my office at St. John's United Church, this chief's got to go. And don't worry, you won't be needing a lawyer, because I'm going to take care of all of this. The day of my testimony, I had a dream in which this same lawyer pulls up in a limousine. I get into the limousine with him. We go a block, and then he lets me out. And I said to him, we've only gone a block. And he says, yeah, I'm only taking you for a ride. And that's exactly what happened. In my trust of him, I got taken for a ride. So I want to say it's still worth it. It's still worth it for us to lean on the side of freedom and responsibility, because as things unraveled, that chief was eventually exposed because he did criminal things in Kenora when he went there right after Marathon. Bill Springer did go to jail. And the beginnings of what was going to be the unraveling of pedophilia as really an international problem. This was pre-Mount Cashel. This was pre-Boston Diocese. The beginning happened in Marathon for us. And as things happen in the great cosmos and in the great interactions of the holy order of things, as Leonard Cohen says, things get revealed in the fullness of time. Each one of us has a North Star residing in our innermost beings. It's called the soul. You know, we can still use that language. It's called the soul. I'm absolutely persuaded, by what I continually witness in my vocational expressions, that the root cause of our stress and distress in our culture is not what we typically believe that it is. It is actually the loss of a sense of our soul. That is at the root cause of all of our stress and distress in this culture. The goodness is that it is often easier to see it and to follow it after it has grown dark. You know, that's why dark nights of the soul are good for people, because it's in the dark night of the soul we discover how important the soul really is. They are necessary. We are in one. We as a collective are in a dark night of the soul. And blessed are those who have the eyes to want to accustom to see in the dark. Our soul is not an idea or a belief. It is an experience. And what is really marvelous is that it can overtake us at times in the midst of our daily lives. As Leonard Cohen once so aptly depicted such occasions, who can explain the molecular structure of this grace? All that we know is we really do experience it from time to time. On Canada Day, while our Prime Minister was tweeting about how extraordinarily compassionate Canada is, Canadians were saying something else in a Gallup poll. That politicians can't be trusted to do the right thing is what the poll found out, and that their primary interest is one in remaining in power. They declared that there are two most critical concerns that have to do with human beings, and that's human-instigated global warming and the widening between the elites and the life conditions of regular folks, the common folks. The soul is generated by hope. And by hope, I do not mean optimism. That's hopium. That's why it's the language of the economists. Economists are always talking in optimism. Hope and optimism are not the same thing. Hope is a spiritual hybrid consisting of both courage and trust. And when it is accompanied by wisdom, it can overturn hell itself. One thing that went wrong with the Obama era was Obama got in because he had kept talking about hope. But if you listen to talks with Cornel West, he said Donald Trump couldn't have happened without Barack Obama. The reason being because Barack Obama had betrayed the hope of the very people who had voted him in, people of the south side of Chicago. When the great crisis happened with the banking types down there, the oligarchs of the banks, what did Barack Obama do? He bailed out the banks and the Wall Street gang. He did not make sure that those who had been screwed by the same were compensated. He also disowned his relationship with Jeremiah Wright, a very prophetic African-American preacher in the south side of Chicago. That's hopium. Hope will always consist of a trust in life as life that does not waver. Trusting in life as life is hope, and it is courage. It is the hybrid. Without courage, there's no such thing as hope. It takes an enormous amount of courage to be hopeful. Suppose we were to reclaim the twins of our actual freedom to self-express and our responsibility to self-express. Suppose we were to reclaim the orphans of the soul, freedom and responsibility. What would be the implications of that? Suppose we were both to visit and to write our political representatives and express our consciences to them about human-instigated global warming and the diminishing life conditions of the masses. Suppose our awakening of our twins results in the awakening of the same in them. We allow our politicians to be left too lonely. We leave them too much alone. They're human beings after all. And they went into office really wanting good things. But we need to remember, just take fossil fuel production. Remember the interests of Russia are at stake here, right? The Arabs are at stake here. Big money is at stake here. And on the other side of the A-frame is, so is the life of the planet at stake here. We need to assess what world we're in and what time it is. The world that we're in says we can do no other than to decide from our freedom to go for broke on conscience being the only way. W.H. Auden was right. It's come down to this, the evidence is in. Love one another or die. And to love one another is going to mean we don't leave our leaders alone. We have to speak to them and let them know that we care about their conscience and their conscience, because we are in an inextricable web of relatedness, like Dr. Martin Luther King said. I can't be all of what I'm supposed to be till you're all of what you're supposed to be, and you can't be all of what you're supposed to be till I'm all of what I'm supposed to be. It's set up that way by the great breath of all breathing. There's tremendous hope in that. Let's go for broke. Let's buy it. I thought it was only appropriate to close with a poem by just a wonderful, wonderful genius of conscience representation, Mary Oliver. Hey. Here's Mary in the cloud of witnesses. Where do I live? If I had no address, as many people do not, I could nevertheless say that I lived in the same town as the lilies of the field and the still waters. Spring and all through the neighborhood, now there are strong people tending flowers, men no less. Beauty without purpose is beauty without virtue, but all beautiful things inherently have their function to excite the viewers towards sublime thought. Glory to the world, that good teacher. Among the swans, there is none called the least or the greatest. I believe in kindness. I also believe in mischief. Also in singing, especially when singing is not necessarily prescribed. As for the body, it is solid and strong and curious and full of detail. It wants to polish itself. It wants to love another body. It is the only vessel in the world that can hold, in a mix of power and sweetness, words, songs, gesture, passion, ideas, ingenuity, devotion, merriment, vanity, and virtue. Keep some room in your heart for the unimaginable. There are many ways to perish or to flourish. How old pain, for example, can stall us at the threshold of function. Memory, a golden bowl, or a basement without light. For which reason the nightmare comes with its painful story and says, you need to know this. Some memories I would give up, anything to forget. Others I would not give up upon the point of death. They are the bright hawks of my life. Still, friends consider stone that is without the fret of gravity and water that is without anxiety. And the pine trees that never forget their recipe for renewal. And the female wood duck who is looking this way and that way for her children, and the snapping turtle who is looking this way and that way also, this is the world. And consider always every day the determination of the grass to grow despite the unending obstacles. I ask you again, if you've been enchanted by this adventure, your life, what would you do for you? And where are you, with your ears bagged down as if the packets of sand were on them? Listen, we all have much more listening to do. Tear the sand away and listen, the river singing. What blackboard could ever have been invented that could hold all the zeros of eternity? Let me put it this way. If you disdain the cobbler, may I assume you walk barefoot? Last week, I met the so-called deranged man who lives in the woods. He was walking with great care so as to not step on any small living thing. For myself, I've walked in these woods for more than 40 years, and I'm the only thing, it seems, that is about to be used up. Or to be less extravagant, will in the foreseeable future be used up. First time I want to step out into some fresh morning and look around and hear myself crying out, the house of money is falling, the house of money is falling, the weeds are rising, the weeds are rising.